This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight...
Addressing journalists Friday in Kenya's capital, Nairobi, the head of the UN mission that just finished a 10-day visit to South Sudan said the country is on the brink of catastrophe.
That's Lenny Ruvaga reporting from Nairobi. Details coming up. Also, former businessman Adama Barrow has defeated longtime President Yahya Jammeh in Gambia's presidential election. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, the Gambian Election Commission announced today the upset victory of former businessman Adama Barrow, who defeated longtime President Yahya Jammeh. Barrow won 45% of the vote and Jammeh received 36%. Barrow was the candidate of a coalition of seven opposition parties. Jammeh rose to power in a military coup in 1994 and won five elections that many observers claimed were not free and fair. Reporter Ricky Shryock is following developments in the Gambia. From Dakar, Senegal, she spoke to VOA's Jody Kapawa about President-elect Adama Barrow.
He's relatively new to politics, to the political scene. The opposition party, UDP, some of their more well-known leaders, I think, have been, you know, arrested leading up to the election, which I think is part of the reason he was maybe thrust to the forefront. He has experience working abroad in the UK, which has also kind of led him to comment about the flow of migrants leaving Gambia and taking the back route through Libya and the boats. He's already spoken about how he wants to kind of address that and hopes to put a stop to that, or at least decrease it, which is a big deal in Gambia. He's spoken about how he's a devout Muslim and how, according to AFP, his faith guides him in every step of his life, including his politics. But also I saw another journalist talking about how his wife was being, quote, blessed by a Catholic priest and friend after the election. The Catholic priest said that shows his religious tolerance.
Now, I understand you're seeing tweets about unusual police behavior on the streets. Would you explain?
Yeah, I'm hearing from Amnesty workers, Amnesty International workers, who are in the Gambia, in Banjul at this time, how an opposition politician who's still in jail, they were outside his home, and there are celebrations going on, obviously because especially his supporters think he might be released now, and the police trucks came toward the house and as these celebrations were going on, and they stood out and waved and smiled at the protesters, and the protesters smiled back. And Amnesty International and I think other people who know the Gambia expressed happy surprise at this. Gambia is a place where people didn't openly speak out about the president for fear of reprisal for years.
Now, the Gambia has not been a very friendly place for journalists. What do you think will happen now that there'll be a new president?
I personally know some colleagues and Gambian journalists who are now located here in Dakar, Senegal, because they have been forced into exile because they were harassed for their journalism in Gambia. And they have said they are excited to go back home. They want to return to their country and practice journalism there. So hopefully that happens. Hopefully there's a peaceful transition and they're allowed to return home and be journalists, because it's a very difficult environment for journalists in the Gambia.
That's reporter Ricky Shryock from Dakar. She spoke to VOA's Jody Kapawa. Also reacting to today's presidential election results in the Gambia is Steve Coburn of Amnesty International. He spoke by satellite phone in Banjul to Jody Kapawa.
We have been working on Gambia for a number of years now. We've been documenting the repression, the restrictions on freedom of expression. And what happened over the last few weeks, maybe the last month, but it is quite remarkable. I think maybe 9 months ago you would not have predicted this. There has been a lot of things happening in that time. There have been protests repressed. There have been people arrested. There have been people who have died in custody. Yeah, over the last 2 weeks, something really interesting happened. People weren't allowed to go out on the streets. People weren't allowed to express themselves in the media. And the population took advantage of that. They went out and campaigned for all parties. They went out and expressed their views and they expressed their rights. And what we're seeing today is a dramatic change from what we would have seen 9 months ago. And, you know, we don't have a particular party. We fought We very much appreciate the expression of the rights that have happened in this election, and we think there's a big task ahead for the authorities to take the measures to transform the human rights situation in this country, including freeing political prisoners. I'm actually outside the house of Hussein Udabo right now, who is the leader of the UDP party, who was arrested and convicted to 3 years imprisonment a few months ago just for having participated in a protest. So it's really important that those sorts of issues are dealt with and the authorities meet their obligations and their promises.
What do you think is the next step now when the new president takes office?
There's a lot of work to do. I think there's a very immediate things you can do, which is to release everyone who has been arrested and detained simply for expressing their opinion. And that includes political prisoners, that includes peaceful protesters, that includes journalists, that includes imams, three imams who were arrested a year ago because they presented a petition. And they've never been seen since. They've never seen their family. They've never seen their lawyer. And those are things that the authorities can do on day one.
That's Steve Coburn of Amnesty International. He spoke by satellite phone in Banjul to VOA's Jody Kapowa. UN human rights monitors are sounding the alarm on South Sudan, saying the ongoing violence in the country will, if not checked, lead to genocide. Lenny Ruvaga has more from Nairobi.
Addressing journalists Friday in Kenya's capital, Nairobi, the head of the UN mission that just finished a 10-day visit to South Sudan said the country is on the brink of catastrophe. Yasmin Suka warned that a repeat of the 1994 Rwandan genocide, which killed an estimated 800,000 people, is in the making in Africa's youngest country. Suka said ethnic cleansing is already underway in parts of South Sudan. She went on to say that the international community needs to pressure all parties to bring about a lasting peace.
The international community, and particularly I think the regional players, IGAD and of course the African Union, I think they need to get these leaders into some sort of process where they agree that they will be talking to each other so that they can put the peace process back on the table. And so it's really important that if they're serious about a peace process, that this is inclusive, that it takes into account all of the real leadership, and of course that it should also include civil society and the faith communities as well as women's groups.
The UN Commission on Human Rights in South Sudan was established in March to monitor the country's human rights situation. 3 years of political and ethnic conflict have killed tens of thousands and displaced more than 2.5 million people from their homes. Earlier this week, the United States said it has credible information that South Sudan's government is targeting civilians in central Equatoria State and is preparing for large-scale attacks, possibly within days. The commissioners are calling for the quick deployment of a 4,000-strong regional protection force that would safeguard civilians, enact targeted sanctions, and implement an arms embargo.
It's absolutely critical to ensure that no more arms go into South Sudan. And there needs to be a really demilitarization process where, in fact, you begin to really deal with the question of a proper security sector reform process.
Speaking earlier to VOA, Atenywek Ateny, a spokesman for South Sudanese President Salva Kiir, denied accusations of ethnic cleansing. He said the problems in his country are political and could be resolved by implementing a peace agreement signed last year. Remember Mia Mingi, an international human rights expert at the University of Pretoria, says that more needs to be done to address the plight of civilians.
The rapid deployment force cannot be a mechanism that will prevent genocide across South Sudan. We're dealing with 4,000 strong force. And you are having a militia close to 75,000 spread across the country, killing, raping, and destroying people on the basis of their ethnicity. There is just no way that 4,000 strong force based in Juba can do anything meaningfully to alter that. If the government that is perpetuating it, if the government that is facilitating it is not taken to task and is not held to account.
The commission will present its final report to the UN Human Rights Council in March. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Nairobi.
Millions of people in South Sudan have been displaced by conflict since 2013, and many are in need of humanitarian aid. But UN officials say relief efforts are being blocked or slowed because aid workers are not able to reach those in need. They're calling for free, safe, and unhindered access to prevent the humanitarian crisis from getting even worse. VOA's Jody Kapawa reports.
A top UN humanitarian official in South Sudan says bureaucratic impediments are among the problems blocking the flow of aid.
So it can be anything from a delay in getting a visa for an international staff member to come into country, to a delay in getting a vehicle registered when it's imported into the country, a wide range of bureaucracy that people need to deal with on a day-to-day basis.
Ian Ridley is head of office in South Sudan for OCHA, the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. He says there are also access constraints. In other words, aid workers just can't get everywhere they need to be.
Often what we're finding is organizations are denied access to particular parts of the country in order to do that.
He gives the example of the town of Wau in western Bahr el Ghazal state.
In Wau, or the areas outside of Wau, we've not been able to deliver humanitarian assistance since June of this year. So there are tens of thousands of people to the south and west of that city that have not received any humanitarian supplies for many months now, and obviously that's a big concern to us.
A similar example can be found around Yei in central Equatoria state. The OCHA official says a lot of time, money and energy have been spent trying to solve these problems.
It becomes a distraction from the real task of delivering humanitarian assistance. So that's something we're very concerned about because we'd rather our staff time and our resources be spent on delivering a system.
Ridley says the bureaucracy and access problems have been brought to the attention of government officials.
We've had a series of meetings with the South Sudanese government. We had a very good meeting several weeks ago and laid out a whole series of the problems that humanitarians are facing. We went into quite some detail, and it was a very constructive meeting. Promises were made to improve the situation. What we haven't seen is the progress that we hoped for as a result of those meetings. So we will be following up with the authorities here in South Sudan.
Besides conflict and a cumbersome bureaucracy, the UN official cites another problem facing aid workers.
A large and growing concern here in South Sudan is the issue of crime, and that is due to the general economic situation. Humanitarian organizations have assets, they have donor funds, so they're often seen as a lucrative source of material and funds for criminal elements.
Ridley warns the humanitarian crisis in South Sudan is steadily getting worse.
A couple of examples of that. The number of people leaving South Sudan as refugees for neighboring countries has increased dramatically over the last several months. There's now over 1.2 million refugees in neighboring countries. And that number is increasing by the day. Thousands of people a day are leaving for Uganda, Kenya, Ethiopia, and Sudan.
Ridley says nearly every part of South Sudan has now been touched by conflict. He says that's a stark contrast from 6 months ago when you could pinpoint the parts of the country in need of humanitarian aid. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Here in Washington, a congressional hearing was held this week on the political and military situations in Libya. The U.S. State Department Special Envoy for Libya, Jonathan Weiner, assessed a joint meeting of the House Subcommittee on the Middle East and North Africa and the Subcommittee on Terrorism, Non-Proliferation and Trade. Representative Ileana Roslenten of Florida chaired the meeting. She said, "Things have gotten worse in Libya since the fall of former leader Muammar Gaddafi 5 years ago and the establishment of the UN-backed Government of National Accord, or GNA.
Libya is more politically divided than ever. Its economy is in a free fall. Terrorist groups and criminals continue to exploit the power vacuum. Multiple governing entities and their allied militias and armed forces compete for power, while the UN-backed unity government, known as the Government of National Accord, remains unable to provide basic security and basic services to the people of Libya. Criminals and terrorist groups, including ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and so many others, take advantage of the chaos, securing their own territory and using Libya as a launching pad for smuggling, for human trafficking, for terror attacks, endangering Libya's neighbors, such as Egypt and Tunisia. Libya is now the main transit point for migrants trying to reach Europe. And with little border security or governance, many are rightly concerned by the potential of terrorists reaching our own shores."
Special Envoy Jonathan Weiner says progress is being made in Libya, particularly in the fight against the terrorist group ISIL, or Islamic State.
"A year ago, ISIL was expanding its presence in Libya, capturing 90 miles of prime Mediterranean coastline around the coastal city of Sirte, a stone's throw away from Europe's southern shores. A year later, the picture looks very different. Now, due to the bravery of GNA-aligned Libyan soldiers, supported since the summer by the skill of U.S. forces, who have conducted more than 450 airstrikes coordinated with our Libyan partners, ISIL controls just a few city blocks in Sirte, and its grasp on even this sliver of Libyan territory is tenuous. In Benghazi and in Libya's east, this has been ISIL and other terrorist groups in other parts of Libya have also been pushed back. In Benghazi and in Libya's east, this has been due to sustained efforts by equally brave Libyan soldiers. So we've seen Libyan soldiers in different parts of the country and with different political orientations taking on terrorism in different parts of Libya. And what was a substantial presence of ISIL in terms of its control of territory in Libya is now all but eliminated."
Weiner says that success could be reversed if Libyans, including militias, fail to join the Government of National Accord or fail to participate in a planned constitutional referendum and elections this year. The special envoy to Libya says things can improve, especially if different factions cooperate with the current government to market the oil. Currently, some groups are trying to sell oil outside legitimate channels. Getting production back to 1 million barrels per day could provide revenues for food, health, utilities, and other services. However, Weiner says support is needed for stabilizing the city of Sirte once forces allied to the Government of National Accord defeat the remains of Islamic State. He says the Obama administration has requested $148 million in foreign assistance to Libya, which would be used to help rebuild Sirte. Weiner says it will also be used to help build an integrated and professional military, one that represents all areas of the country. Twenty-four past the hour, you are listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Flash floods have struck farmers in Zimbabwe and other southern African countries in recent weeks. Weather experts predict heavy rains due to a global weather pattern called La Niña. It is the opposite of El Niño, which brought a dry spell in which millions of Zimbabweans suffered food insecurity. Kudzai Zivinashe reports on the heavy rains that could result from La Niña.
Experts say southern African nations should brace for heavy rains that may result into flash floods. Zimbabwe Meteorological Service head Tichawana Zinyemba says there is no need to panic as the season will ultimately record normal rainfall.
Last year, our season was very poor. The emphasis is on normal.
Florence Mutambanengwe, professor of social science and agricultural engineering at the University of Zimbabwe, explains La Nina climate.
Loosely speaking, La Nina is the opposite of El Nino. It is a phenomena associated with very high rainfall, including the rainfall events. And the rainfall can be cyclonic, implying that there is high incidences of La Nina occurs when the waters cool, and this brings favorable cloud formation conditions, bringing favorable rainfall events.
Mutambanengwe shares the views of the meteorological services that the weather pattern is welcome.
The La Nina event could be, in a way, welcome in Zimbabwe, given the desperate water situation the country is experiencing. I mean, look, there is no surface water to talk about. The groundwater stocks are severely depleted. Dams have dried up. Boreholes have dried up. And people are even buying drinking water in the villages. So if we have an event like that, which can fill up our dams at least and recharge our groundwaters, then I think it would really come as a welcome relief.
While there is no way of telling how intense the rainfall events will be, Mutambanengwe says if the worst comes, a lot of sectors in Zimbabwe will be affected.
Apart from the crop production and agriculture, also the livestock is likely to be impacted if the rains are too much, or some of the livestock cannot withstand the damp conditions. So we're expecting other sectors, of course, the mining. It can also impact the tourism. Let's not forget the education sector in the villages. Our children go to school on foot, and once those rivers and streams are in flood, it means not going to school for a week or 2 weeks until the river subsides.
The Tobacco Marketing Board of Zimbabwe is preparing tobacco farmers to survive this like they survived the El Nino climate last season. The board spokesperson Ishaune Sumoyo says they are raising awareness and training their farmers.
The preparations for the next season are quite good because, for instance, if you look at the number of registered farmers, so far we have registered over 60,000. So it means farmers are preparing for this coming season, and we're also taking them through agronomic lessons because we will probably, according to the weather reports, we may experience a La Nina. So we are preparing them if we encounter heavy rain so that we can be able to produce a good yield again.
This warning comes at a time when Zimbabwe is not ready to handle any crisis. Mutambanengwe says the government is limited on what it can do in any case of a crisis. Mutambanengwe says Zimbabwe's best bet is the early warning system of the Southern African Development Community, otherwise known as SADC.
SADC has initiated an early warning system, and we have one at the University of Zimbabwe and the Department of Geography. They are responsible for relaying information to SADC nations.
Zimbabwe Meteorological Services says there is no need to panic, but have issued a warning of flash floods in the past week. Only time can tell if they will issue any more warnings. This is Kudza Iznawashe, reporting for Voice of America from Harare.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Thanks for choosing The Voice of America. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. On weekends, tune into Nightline Africa at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here. Only the best on VOA Africa.